Thank you. Good morning. Sorry I'm late. So welcome to this work session. I'm going to turn it over immediately to Commissioner Fish and the PERB. Yes, please.
Gordon, welcome.
Thank you. Yes, Gordon Feiner, interim chair of the Portland Utility Review Board.
Gordon Feiner, interim chair of the Portland Utility Review Board.
Catherine Howells, member of the Portland Utility Review Board.
And I'm John Gibbon. I'm the West Side representative to the Portland Public Utility Review Board.
Mayor, since David Schatz is here as director of the Water Bureau, would you have any objection if we had him sit at the table? David, even though he's not the president of the case, why don't you join us?
I know if you're related to Libby Schatz, the new mayor of Oakland.
I don't think so.
She might want to be. She seems pretty. Yeah, just matter of fact.
No, I've not heard of
it. And also, because it's a broader and proportional voting system. They have California Ranked Vote. So she was selected on the 15th round of the process. Initially getting 26% of the vote, so I'm close to about that.
Had you been a city council person before? You know,
not aware of it.
Folks, we have to use our microphones, otherwise we're not on record.
Okay. Topic, so therefore it didn't matter.
You know, it's like runoff voting is the favorite cause the former basis put up in the lot. We're going to let Catherine start.
Oh, thank you for having us.
No, I am trainable over time. Thank you for having us. We realize this is our swan song. So we will share with you what we know, what we've learned over time, and also I hope we can have a dialogue on how we can help with the transition to the pub. So we're more than willing to help with that transition and what we've learned over time. We want to begin with our annual report and go through some of the recommendations. We want to look at sort of the PERB participation in budget setting and also in the Administrative Review Committee process, which is an integral part where we really learn what some of the citizens' concerns are. And that's one of our concerns going forward, what will happen with ARC. And we'll also talk about, since we look at rates for solid waste, too, where it's going to reside, because we do have some concerns that that won't be taken as seriously, and it really is a serious part of the whole infrastructure of the city. Without garbage running smoothly, it would get really ugly. I was in New York City during a garbage strike once. It wasn't just ugly, it was smelly. The rats ruled. So, annual report. We sent it to you in September, and what we did is we sort of went over what our charter was, what we do as a committee, and we also have subcommittees. So we have the water, the BES subcommittee, and the solid waste subcommittee. So this is broken down by each of the committees. As we go through our process, we have quite a dialogue with all of the bureaus. I would say, personally, and you guys can chime in, that the dialogue we have with the Water Bureau is the most productive. It has had more depth of information. Staff is always well prepared, very responsive in getting back to us as far as any questions we might have over time. That the structure of how the Water Bureau goes through their budget process from the BACs, the Budget Advisory Committee, onward should really be a model for everyone. And that's one of the things we requested is that, and Nick, you know this, that BES do a very similar process. They're getting there, but I would say they're not there yet as far as the transparency of their capital projects. They have a very different way of structuring their budget, and it's not intuitively obvious even to the informed observer sometimes. The other thing that we requested, and the Water Bureau is certainly starting to do, when you do percent increase, people can't do that in their heads, and they say 7%, we can't afford that. Do dollar amounts. It makes a huge difference in public perception. And that's something we've found over time, is if you talk about sort of 7% or whatever the increase is, if you say it's $1.73 a month, people go, oh, okay. So that perception of percentage is a crucial part in how we all talk about what's going on with rates. Personally, I also want to share the fact that what people don't understand is this isn't just sort of administrative costs going up. The cost of pipe is going up. What, ductile iron's gone up 80% in the last 10 years or something like that. So just the cost of materials is phenomenally more expensive. And it would help to know that for people to understand that it's the cost of the materials that drives a lot of that, plus the cost of paving the roads after they have to dig them up, which is an integral part of the whole, how do you manage streets? Because streets are part of urban infrastructure, and people don't understand it's a right-of-way for everyone. Everything's under the streets. Looking at a diagram of New York City streets, okay, they might have a little bit of snow on them today, but just looking at a diagram of New York City street and what's under the streets, I'm just amazed any traffic can drive on those streets. It's really quite an engineering miracle how much they put under the streets. So it would behoove the whole city to sort of understand, here's the street, but here's what's under the streets, and here's why streets sometimes break down faster. My favorite example on streets, I know I'm a little off topic right now, is the bus stop right out here on Madison and 4th. And I watched that as one of my bus stops, and how the bus traffic really sort of totally wore down that street. They hadn't thought about that many buses stopping at that place, and it's one of the challenges. So I think streets are actually looking at urban infrastructure and the utilities cohesively would be a very, very useful piece. We did request that BES provide information in a similar format to the Water Bureau, because we really like the Water Bureau's CIP reports and the way they really go through the budgets. You could really track it as a citizen. And John, you sat on the BES committee this year, so do you want to talk about that experience?
My impression is that the requests we made to BES were responded to well in terms of them explaining their operational divisions. We got good materials on that. I really honestly think, though, that the CIP is really what we're putting, my sense of putting a pub together for. The BES capital improvement program is massive. It's, you know, the reliability and maintenance, I looked at it, $356 million over the next 5 years, and then $71 million more for watershed-type spending, plus $140 million for the treatment plants. With all due respect to David's projects, he's done a wonderful job over the last few years of giving technical detail on most of the projects that the Water Bureau's got in short, concise paragraphs. And I'm trying to remember the member of PERB who was an engineer from East Portland that pushed so hard for that.
Mike Green.
Mike, yeah. And that's really useful. I'm not sure how we're going to get there with the CIP for the BES, but I think we've got to try to get that explained, that it's just not there yet, but they've made a lot of progress in explaining their operational divisions to us through this budget process.
Sean, can I ask you a question on that?
Sure.
Last year, we did, for the first time, a joint CIP presentation, Water BES. And one of the advantages for me as a relatively new commissioner in charge was I got to find out how they both looked at CIP, how they talked about it, and we hammered out sort of a consistent baseline. So the reports, they both had to report on their CIP using the same framework. A, did you find that helpful? And B, do you think we need, how might we improve that process?
Well, I think the Mike Crane, I didn't get the sense that BS has got a bigger project process, and Gordon was there for most of it too. I felt they're big and they're diverse projects, and you know, Water Bureau projects are pretty concise. You can show it with a map or a picture of a pump station or something like that, and it springs back to you in a paragraph. I think I looked through most of the material that got to the BAC this time, and that wasn't there yet for the individual projects, the individual, the individual reliability and maintenance projects. I think there's 10 on the east side, and I think the way they're budgeting that is they're including the infiltration, the INI projects on the west side, and there's a couple of reliability, or at least one reliability and maintenance on the west side. So I think there's about 12 projects, but those aren't presented in that concise detail yet by BES. I think they can work through to it, but right now it's gotten the operational side is pretty well explained in short, concise PowerPoint materials, but not the CIP. And obviously that's the tail that's wagging the dog in terms of, you know, one of the things that came up was capital improvement was, go ahead.
I think the overview CIP report that was presented to council was really good. It's the first time we'd really seen that consolidation, and this is it. It's like speaking the same language for the first time.
Good analogy, because that's what it felt like in the preparation.
I bet. Two languages, two cultures. And I think that's part of the challenge with BES is they have a different culture in how they organize things. But how they organize things doesn't get to the crucial bits of the CIP sometimes. It's like it's such big projects. But the overview on the CIP and how much of the budget it takes was a really, really good thing to see the two big utilities. Big utilities. Gordon, do you have anything to add for that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that the CIP is, I mean, as John said, the tail that wags the dog there. And the BAC process this year and most years prior generally concerns relatively small expenditures compared to the CIP, just for operations and maintenance and administration. And it ultimately is kind of picking around the edges of the budget. It's not necessarily something that, well, what is presented for analysis to the BAC is not something that's going to significantly change rates in one direction or the other. Now, to a large degree, the BAC doesn't have the time or the expertise to really delve in to make recommendations on large CIP projects. So I understand why that's not really presented. It's also projects that are planned in with a much longer term view. And so year to year, that's not really where the decisions are made. But it is, it has been a bit of a source of frustration that we look at a $300-something million budget oftentimes, and then we're getting down to, at the end, making decisions on things that are worth $100,000 or $200,000, and not decisions, recommendations on these decision packages. And ultimately, it begins to feel like there's not a whole lot of impact that is being made by the entire process. I think measures have been taken this year, bringing in a facilitator to move that process along in the right direction. But and I think John can probably speak to it as well, that this year's process, again, kind of left us feeling like, okay, we've done this, but we're really only kind of viewing a very small spectrum of the overall expenditures of the Bureau.
Yeah, the point I think that we came to was realizing that, you know, we're recommending a 3.8% increase, and I know Catherine doesn't like me to talk about it in those terms, but 3% of it was capital spending and debt service, and almost untouchable from the BAC's point of view. And we made a decision and made recommendations on a half a dozen decision packages that amounted to about $1.5 million, you know. And like Gordon said, $300-400 million budget, and we're giving you advice and some good people from some good organizations inside the city. You know, Port of Portland, OHSU had both contributed. BOMA had somebody there. I think they wanted to get their hands around more if they could have, but it's just not possible in a BAC process. And I'm really hopeful that the pub will take that strategic look, get some technical expertise, and start looking at that program. The other side of it is, you know, the CIP project, the CIP presentation you heard said, you know, the big stick in the room is the federal regulations, and meeting federal regulations is such a challenge and getting so costly, and it's handed back to the citizens in every community. You know, I can remember when I started, I'm dating myself, the 70s, we were getting tons of money to build like the USA system in Washington County, and that ain't happening anymore. It's not coming from Washington. We're having to pay the tab ourselves, and it's a lift.
The pub concept envisions a year-round body with professional staff looking at both CIP and operating, so it gets explicitly at the question that you've raised. You have in past years disagreed with the rates that the city adopts. In some instances, you've said they were too modest. You have argued for a bigger rate increase. One of the unknowns that we're gonna find out about is if you make the CIP process more transparent, and if you really open up the conversation about what is the replacement schedule on pipes, how resilient is our system, and the like, we may very well have an independent body that comes in and says, you're underinvesting, and you could gut your operations, but just on the capital side, you're underinvesting, and you ought to, you know, increase rates. So any thoughts on that?
I was in the shower this morning and have exactly the same thought. I mean, it really could if we – I was thinking that – I would like to see the pub have some, in addition to budget expertise, some technical expertise to look at the technical decisions that are being made in terms of some of these sewer and especially the CIP projects in the Bureau of Environmental Services. And yeah, I think you, but maybe that's a good thing to have a independent voice that has got some background and some staff that supports them to take a look at it. And I'll give you my, one last thought on that. I went to a meeting on Sunday afternoon talking about sewer and water and streets in Southwest Portland, Capital Highway Project. And I explained to people that right now we're at $65 a year in sewer charges inside the city of Portland. And if we add in some of the projects that they want to talk about for capital highway improvement, it's probably going to raise. And in 10 years, they're going to be paying $88. And the response back was, well, if we spend it, I'd like to know it's going to do something that fixes a problem in my neighborhood. And that's, you know, that transparency part of it is going to have to be a big part of it.
And I would say the Water Bureau, since I sit on the Water Committee, has really figured out a way to present the whole CIP budget And yeah, it's how they structure their budget that allows them to do it, but it's really by project. And the BAC really looks at every capital project. Now, my fear with people getting into the weeds with capital projects is they're going to be second-guessing the engineers. And that's a very difficult road to go down. It's one thing to sort of ask. It's another thing to go, well, you should engineer it this way instead or something. And if you're not an engineer, we're hurting the professionalism of engineers sometimes. It's one thing to ask them to explain while they're doing something. It's another thing for citizens to say, well, you should do it this way instead. So I have a real fear you're going to be spending too much time dinking around in the weeds in ways that's really not going to move it forward. I think the Water Bureau, BAC in particular, has been very good looking at resilience and looking at sort of the age of pipes and looking at asset management as far as here the decisions we're making on how to replace type pipes over time. So it's a very, very good model that really could be used. That I personally believe that the BAC got a lot of information about CIP projects. And the cost of what I call kicking the can too far down the road. And that's something that as you balance rates, you really don't want to kick the can too far down the road. It gets a whole lot more expensive.
Yeah, that leads me to a big, dumb, broad question that I should have asked at some point before this. Maybe I didn't or forgot the answer. But I remember hearing that we're on a 400-year replacement cycle for our water and sewer pipes and being told that the pipes weren't designed to last for 400 years. And the follow-up question I'd like you to ask is, so does that mean that on our current trajectory, there's a point like 20, 30 years from now where we expect things to start breaking down and we don't have a water and sewer system?
From the perspective of the Water Bureau, generally we use around 300 years for different pieces that we're on a replacement cycle for. So, for instance, we're on what we estimate about a 300-year replacement cycle for services, the small line that goes from the main to the meter at the house. So, yes, we're behind in those, but they're individual, they're small individual projects. Portland, our chief engineer likes to say, is a great place to be a pipe. Generally, while pipe life is often considered to be around 100, 115 years in some places in the country, we're figuring 150 to 200 years. So we're not losing ground right now. We're not making a lot of headway. But we have plans over the next 5 to 10 and 20 years to look at our major infrastructure. So transmission, mains, conduits, that sort of thing.
But if you're in a 300-year cycle and you're sort of replacing and you think your pipes can last for 150 years, that does sound like there's a point at which it's unsustainable.
We have our asset management folks are looking, and we do have a bubble on the horizon in the next 30 or 40 years that we're going to have to be addressing.
BS chief engineer at one of the BAC meetings within the last couple months said that for the sewer system, it is a 400-year, basically a 400-year replacement cycle, and that we're managing the replacements we're doing as a risk-based kind of replace the worst of the worst at this point. That's the maintenance and reliability projects that we've got going. I guess a big part of that, though, is in addition to replacing the pipes, is there's a big part of that is the chiclets of the gumdrops and chiclets routine. The BS is also dealing with stormwater in that situation, and the reality of the situation is we ain't going to replace pipes to deal with all the stormwater. We're going to have to do something else in your streets with stormwater. I mean, or someplace, either the streets or the parks, where we can manage that stormwater, and that's a different process.
Thanks for the heads up.
Wait, thank you for that advertisement, because even the CSO project was not intended to be foolproof. We could have spent twice as much and still not guarantee there won't be overflows. That's why we want to disconnect as much stormwater as possible from the system. That's why we want to invest in green infrastructure and other things to get it out of the system, so that we aren't adding every time we have these torrential rains, which then cause overflows.
Well, and here's one of the challenges. Portland's ahead of the game. With a lot of cities are going to start seeing the regulations around this. So how do you balance the regulatory environment versus the need to replace the pipes and have it on a natural cycle? One of the things I learned from the engineer in charge of the big pipe project, who's now working for Thames Water doing their big pipe in London, the big project, is that the pipe on the east side couldn't be sized any bigger because of the footings of the I-5 bridge. And again, you don't take, and that's something, it's like finally the light bulb went on. It's like, well, you could have built it bigger. They couldn't have built it bigger, so they actually have to do stormwater capture differently. And that's something that people should be told, that our installed base of infrastructure constrains what we can do. And people aren't told that part of the story, and I think it's a big piece of the story. And it makes Portland even more exciting. It's like, wow, we couldn't build this any bigger. We have to do this way. It's not, I sort of saw a lot of the bioswales, and I live in Southeast, as, you know, sort of shiny baubles of sustainability. They're not. They have to be integral. But we have to have the long-term management and planning around them. We have to really study them and see, make sure they're really effective there. The other thing I want to add about sewer systems and replacement is, in some respects, it's easier to deal with water, because water's under pressure. You know where it leaks. Sewer's gravity-fed. You don't know where it leaks until it backs up or does something. That's a huge piece of the problem. In a sewer system, you really don't know where it's broken down until it starts showing itself. So they're scoping the sewers, and they're really trying to find out. But again, it's gravity-fed. The lowest point is the Willamette River, so that's where it's going to go. So there are a lot of challenges that, again, I think what John brought up is that the BAC process has allowed us to learn a lot more about how these systems work. And it's not just PERB that meets once a month. It's the BAC process during the budget cycle. And I have found that the people who sit on the water BAC to be very, very informed, because they've done it long enough. We do our learning curve. We go, oh, that's what this is about this year. Oh, we understand what the old pipes are, because they've been there for a while. So one of the challenges in PUB is to do the learning curve of what a water utility and a sewer utility basically is all about. And it will be challenging the first year. It will take a lot of staff time in BES and the Water Bureau to educate these people. So that's something to put into the mix, is the amount of staff time and the number of staff people involved in the process. It's a lot.
Just one comment. She's right that most of the city is gravity fed, but in Southwest we have some notable areas where we have pressure lines with sewage and have had some major issues with particularly Multnomah Boulevard and the pipe from the Fano Creek pump station that have given us fits over the years. I want to go back to mentioning something about streets, because last night I was at another meeting. Well, it's an important one. It's the Tryon Stevens Headwaters project, where with some money from Metro, we've done the BS and PBOT is doing a project to look at stormwater and transportation in Southwest together. We had 65 new faces at a meeting last night. 65 new faces. I mean, 15 of the usual suspects and staff, but 65 people showed up at a meeting. They're interested in that. People are, and that's a good, it was a good demonstration of when the city works with two bureaus working together. I was impressed. It really was impressive. And that's what we're going to need more of all over the city, because every place we deal with stormwater, we have different issues. I've written something that will get to you as soon as PERB has a chance on the comp plan. I'm perfectly willing to be, if Don Bach's Mr. Trails, I'm perfectly willing to be Mr. Stormwater. And I'll tell you that, you know, even in East Portland, where we think, oh, we can just dispose of the stormwater into the aquifer or the layers of gravel and it'll go away, I have concerns about it, because when we were going through the comprehensive planning process, we had a meeting where we said, okay, let's try to find some place to put light industrial spots in East Portland. And the BPS staff identified like four or five spots, and we sat down at a table with some people from the business community and started talking about these areas where, hey, that's where we could put light industrial. And the first thing staff said was, well, we've kind of got a high water table problem in these areas. Yeah. And, you know, we're disposing of our stormwater as best we can out there, but it's working fine, but it cuts down our choices and cuts down some of the decisions we'd like to be able to make to help that community. So
one comment, yeah, on that. You know, BES, water, and transportation are trying to work more collaboratively. In fact, Steve and Leah Treat have proposed a system where the private utilities and the public utilities would all coordinate construction together. And I think a good example of where that would be helpful is the project we just completed on Division. BES, transportation, worked very effectively, complicated project, obviously had a lot of disruption for the businesses. We were there for the ribbon cutting. There was a lot of, you know, relief that it was over. Well, a few weeks later, we started getting emails from people somewhat upset that there was some work being done. Well, that's because the utilities came in later, dug up the street to do some of their pieces. And so I think PBOT's absolutely right on this, that we've got to figure out a way to coordinate also with our private utilities so that we minimize the impact. And it's just more efficient.
And those were the private utilities coming in. Cable, right, and stuff was coming in, and right, CenturyLink. Yes, I watched that one. So let's move on to some of the challenges that we've had this past year. Challenge number one, recruitment. It's been a very challenging year. I mean, with the election last March, with the City Club report, with the Blue Ribbon Commission, it's been almost impossible to really find new people to sit on PERB. Everyone said, well, we don't know if it's going to exist. So we do have one new member, so we at least have a quorum. But we want you to know we haven't given up, that we really did try hard. And we actually did a brochure sort of trying to get people to understand what PERB was about. And I'm just sharing this with you because with the recruitment for PUB, how do you do this outreach? I mean, we've gone to a lot of citizens' organizations and trying to get people involved. Most of them don't want to take the amount of time. Most of them actually, what I've heard a lot is, no, I really trust the utilities. It's okay. And I think the election showed that an awful lot, that that the utilities were really trusted. So getting people to sit on this who do not have a specific agenda is going to be very, very challenging, shall we say. And I just want to point that out. Go ahead.
And especially if you're trying to recruit 15 members, I mean, we've had difficulty maintaining quorum on a 9-member board. So I think there needs to be a concerted effort on behalf of the various departments of the city to try to reach out to a wide array of potential members and just really put on, say, a full court press to get your membership stocked up from the beginning so that, you know, inevitably you'll probably have some attrition from it. Things happen in people's lives and they'll need to drop off. So if you start out without full membership, then it's probably going to be very difficult to maintain at least a decent level throughout the duration of, is it a 2-year or 4-year term for members on the pub? Okay, right. So
everything.
Things to think about then.
I respect my colleague's position on this, but I think you can hear in my descriptions of where I've been the last couple of nights. I don't think you're going to find people who don't have something of an agenda. I've tried to do my time on PERB while leveraging it with things I do for Sweeney and in Southwest. You know, and I don't think that's the wrong thing to do. The thing that I found that's been frustrating, and CUB has helped us a little bit with this, for the longest time, PERB talked about wanting to get out and meeting with all the neighborhood associations. And I was in favor of that, although I do a lot of that anyway. And we never got there. And then when we had a report from CUB last month, they're doing it. They're Jeff and Janice are getting out and hitting the 97 neighborhoods and going to the meetings and introducing themselves, and that may be a good role for them, and it may be that's the way to do that rather than expect PUB to do it.
Can I just distinguish between agendas and expertise? So, for example, I can't imagine an oversight body that doesn't have someone with a depth of understanding about green infrastructure. I can't imagine an oversight body that doesn't have someone that has some expertise in labor issues or generally, or someone that doesn't have a background in management and operations, or possibly someone that in the past has worked for utility. And as those are, you know, we have to decide what are the areas of expertise that may translate into having certain views, agendas, but I think first and foremost, we need to figure out what are the kinds of expertise we want on here, and what's the mix, and then find the best people for those positions.
What's your opinion of having some of the seats designated for specific areas of the city? Has that worked well, or has that been a problem?
It has been difficult to fill things based on geography, strictly based on geography. Again, since we've had multiple vacancies, there have been numerous angles at which people could approach the slots. So I think we tend to have had at least one member from each of the designated geographical areas, because what, John's west side, is Tom is east side?
And Janice was the inner east side person.
Right,
and
I
helped recruit John and the others. So I think that's something for all of us to be aware of, is that it's a whole council helping to find members who, as Commissioner Fish said, everybody has an agenda. Otherwise, why would you bother serving on a board? But to make sure that it's balanced. The other thing I just want to note, John, is that there's a difference between the Citizens Utility Board, who are the outside advocate watchdog, and the Citizens Board. At the presentation that I was at CUB, it was very much that CUB did at a neighborhood association when I was there and talking about the Parks Bond. It was very much they were talking about their organization and how they were needed rather than what the utilities were or were not doing.
And I would encourage you to be able to keep slots open and available to people who are interested, because I think you need more than a warm body in a seat, but if someone's interested to a large degree and they, you know, their specific geographic slot or professional area of expertise slot or whatever is not open, there probably should be a good number of at-large seats available to fit them. I mean, I'm, I could slide in under geographic for East Side as a public interest advocate or as a small business owner now, but you know, there are a lot of people who don't necessarily have all of those boxes to check necessarily.
And one of the things that we've found is we've tried to recruit members and talk to members is going through to some of the professional organizations for water is there are an awful lot of engineering firms that have a lot of expertise, and they don't want to be tarred with conflict of interest. And that's, I mean, I've been tarred with conflict of interest because I teach at PSU and the Water Bureau is an integral part of my class. But the engineering firms are very, very wary of being tarred with any conflict of interest. So you're not necessarily going to get the expertise you really want on the pub. And I think that's really sad because you really need that expertise.
You know, it hasn't prevented PDC from getting developers or Planning Sustainability Commission from getting people. So I think you're right to flag that, but we also have rules in place that require people to disclose actual conflicts and then without preventing us from getting the expertise. But I think the recruitment process is going to be critical to the success of this new idea. And it sounds like all three of you are going to have great ideas that could help us as we shape what is the recruitment, who are we looking for. And my hope is that by sharpening the definitions and the focus of what this body does, giving them dedicated staff, and then embedding them into what the bureaus do, we'll have a chance to recruit good people. But I think all the barriers that you've identified, we're going to have to address, and I will look forward to, all of us look forward to talking to you more about this so we can figure out how to get the best people.
I guess my response, and I've pondered this a little bit, quite a bit. I felt like being Mr. Southwest, if you will, I got a lot of support. I mean, I got a lot of good ideas and a lot of information, and it made me a more astute observer. I think David will admit that I kind of get him down to the street level, kind of why is it happening, and why did this pipe go bad, why did this tree go down kind of thing at times. But, I mean, that's what I hear, and I think it's a good feedback loop. But my sense of it is that maybe the area representatives are not needed for pub, I'm sorry, because I still want to see that staff used robustly and have a really big picture look at some of these big projects that we're facing in the future. And I'm not sure that the neighborhood perspective, while it's useful, and hopefully pub will develop some sort of a process that people with the neighborhood agenda can come in and tell them about their problems. But I would hope that they do the real big picture and see where we're going. And maybe we're going to say they need to spend more money and figure out a way to do it and develop the credibility that will allow us to do what we have to do in terms of a utility system.
And I think, Commissioner Fish, what you said about really getting down and defining what conflict of interest is going to help your recruitment. Make it real clear this is not a conflict of interest if you work for an engineering firm that also has a contract with the city, for instance. Or is it? A lot of people have contracts with the city. So that's going to be a real challenge of legally, sort of, what is conflict of interest here, and public perception, because people won't touch it if they think they're going to hurt their careers, basically, right?
Yeah.
And I would say, I don't want to speak for Gordon and John, but I think PERB is more than happy to help with this transition. And that's one of the things on our agenda is how can we help with the transition to pub, because we do have some expertise. People do need to understand they're going through a very steep learning curve the first year or two, that these are not, well, even in my class, I start out and people go, oh yeah, we understand water systems. And by the second week, they're going, we had no idea how complicated this was. That you look and start looking at all the different factors. So to be able to frame it in a way that people get that complexity early on will help, I think, in pub.
Well, let me, Jim Blackwood on my staff is currently working on translating recommendations to ordinances and then beginning to facilitate this process. He's home with whatever is going around today, this week. Perhaps what we ought to consider is at the point in which we've got kind of a working framework and we're thinking about details, that we ask to set up a meeting with you to come in and get some feedback upstream and just give us your best guidance. And at that point, we could then take the concept and start discussing it with the council informally, and then perhaps do a work session at council and see if we can get to an agreement. But I'd like to have the chance to bring you in upstream and have you give us sort of all the cautionary, you know, give us all of your concerns up front, and particularly in the context of what's worked and what hasn't worked in your experience in this body. And so we'll make that commitment. And with one caveat, assuming I still have the utilities, and depending on what our assignments are, but it's we'd like to get that expertise upstream. So we will, if we can, we'll take you up on the offer.
And I think getting the expertise from the BACs and the bureaus themselves, because they're intimately involved in all of these boards. And I think understanding the amount of staff time from these utilities is going to be an integral part too, because this could just suck up a phenomenal amount of time of people wanting, you know, in-depth explanations on every engineering project. That's my nightmare, personally. I just think that would not be appropriate.
You know, it reminds me, once I served on a nonprofit board, as they call it, Volunteers of America, Oregon. And in my orientation, Kay Turan described the role of a board member. And she said, you stay in your lane, I'll stay in my lane, we'll complement each other. And what I hear you saying, and I think it's right, is that we have to make sure that people understand what their role is, and we don't want a body that's coming in and telling engineers how to execute a plan. We know at council from the presentations we're getting from both bureaus, we have tremendously competent people charged with actually doing the capital work. What we need, though, is someone looking at our enterprise and saying, we have a question about why you're doing this sequence in your capital spending. We want to know why you're not investing more in resilience. We want to know whether you have the right staff configuration. We want to understand whether you're harnessing technology efficiently. Is your billing system up to date? I mean, those are the things we want to hear from. But we have to be clear about what lanes people are to be in and what their role is. Because the Bureau has a lot of talent. Both bureaus have a lot of talent in executing the game plan. And we're certainly not asking people to second-guess engineers. And I appreciate your concern about that.
I want to stress I'm not... I think the big nugget is the capital improvement program, but Jim sitting down just made me... I call him Mr. Base Charge. I mean, that's
term of affection.
Yes, it is. I really do. He and I, you know, we're, I don't know, but Mr. Stormwater, I hope, like I said, the volumetric charge for BS is a good thing in a lot of ways, but to run this big a program and spend this amount of money we have to spend over the years, that's another thing that I think Pub has to have the expertise and ability to take take a look at that issue and make a decision about maybe a base charge for BES in the end, because we've got such a big line of projects laid out. Although, you know, the good news is that in replacement, we get out to about 2024 and we get to a situation where we're not going to have to, if we get these projects done in the next 10 years, we're not looking at so much growth in BES for a period of time, because we've got the worst of the worst taken care of and some of these problems that they've identified addressed. So, you know, 10 years is a long time, but there's some light at the end of that tunnel to some extent. But we ought to be thinking about how we address it, you know, paying for it beyond there.
Kevin, do you want to take a moment to talk about rates? Or do you want to stick with challenges?
Well, we could talk about rates, sure.
But your report
lays
out, I mean, in quite clearly, these various areas. I think it just, while we still have everyone's focus, I think it'd be helpful to have your comments on rates. I do want to say that the one thing that I learned during my first year and a half or whatever on the job is that there's usually a pretty significant difference between projected rates and actual rates. And partly that's because there's some very conservative assumptions that are made. And I think that's a question we have to revisit at some point, because what happens is some of our critics take the scary numbers over here, the projection rates, and they treat them as if those are the actual numbers. And then this is the second or third budget cycle where because of favorable interest rates, because of favorable costs on projects, contracting, because of good budgeting, because of, you know, a whole host of factors, we've come in significantly below projections. It doesn't mean the projections are bogus numbers. It just means they're highly conservative. But people tend to focus on those sometimes and not enough actually on the actuals. So you want to talk to us a little bit about your view of the, and let me just put the numbers on the table. The projected rate this year for BES was 4% increase, and the recommendation you have is 3.85. And the Water Bureau, the projected rate increase was 11.3%, and the recommendation is 7%. And to put that in context, because you've very wisely said put numbers on it, not percentages, and then, you know, make sure people understand the blended. What that means in plain English, since BES is about two-thirds of everyone's monthly bill and water is about a third of their monthly bill, it means that the blended rate increase would be under 5%. And this would be the third year in a row it comes in under 5%, which in the context of what's going on regionally with some of our partners is a pretty good number. So could you share some thoughts about the rates?
One of the things that the Water BAC does is really go through sort of, here's why we set this projection, and what they, Cecilia is very, very good at walking through, and David, of walking through why we don't need quite that much. And CBO's been very, very helpful of saying, here's the rates that are going out for bonds, et cetera, that could bring down rates. So it's managing public perception, but at the same time, you want to see long-term rate projections, because, for instance, Water Bureau is going to have a spike when Washington Park gets started and gets built, and you want people to know that. So how do you normalize this over time? I think in PURB, given the BAC process and the PURB process and really looking at rates and discussing rates, that we understand that in great depth, that we're not really surprised by, that's just, you know, run a flag up the flagpole sort of thing, but we know that you're working to get that down a lot more. The fear is you get it down so much, you cannot do the resilience, you can't do the long-term that's going to, our aging infrastructure issues that is going to make a huge difference in the long-term.
Well, it's one of the reasons why we use the language of stabilizing rates because we don't want to set unrealistic expectations. You can get rates down to zero, but at what cost? At what cost? And if you give people the impression that that can be done and don't tell them that it's at that it essentially means you're playing Russian roulette with the pipes and the system, that there's extreme vulnerability and a greater likelihood of service disruptions, then you're doing a disservice. So we use the language of stabilization. And I think one area that we need to continue to do a better job is explaining how what our tools are for stabilizing rates, including the Rate Stabilization Fund. But how can we keep the rate more consistent? Because we don't want it to spike. We want to have that more over a five-year period. It seems to me we want to have some consistency.
And that's the long-term planning that's going on. I mean, anecdotally, I'll tell you what I tell people. People go, water's too expensive. And I go, really? So it's about less than $30 a month for an average household of four. That's $1 a day for all the water you use. Really? And they go, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. So they're tools of communication that would make a big difference.
Catherine, I was just curious if you ever asked somebody, if the water and sewer service all went away tomorrow, what would you pay to bring it back?
I do that with my students. The first day of class is 7 days without water. It's how I get their attention. And they go, we had no idea how precious this was.
Well, yeah. We still struggle with the fact that people get a bill quarterly and we'll be aggressively moving to fix that. We'll have an announcement this week. We also get a bill that looks like it's a water bill. And in reality, it's a sewer bill with a water charge. Because the sewer stormwater is two-thirds. And then, David, just for example, what does it cost our customer? What does 2 gallons of water cost our customer?
4 cents. Two gallons for a penny. Sorry, so I don't do math in my head very well.
I think when we break it down to things that are more manageable, for, you know, that sort of are real world, and go to the grocery store and buy some bottled water. It's 2 gallons for a penny. And when you look at it in those terms, that seems like a reasonable cost for the service.
And I think people forget how much they use water for different functions in their house. We tend to talk about drinking water. What would you do if you couldn't do your laundry? You couldn't take a shower, couldn't brush your teeth, you couldn't cook. So going through all these, flush the toilet, yeah, all of these, going through sort of what would it look like if you couldn't, if literally there was no water in your house, is what really gets people's attention. And it gets people's attention on the sewer side too, because then they realize that it's really, water's an integral part of the sewer system.
Your review of the Bureau's proposed rates, and that would be the initial recommendation that comes to the commissioner in charge, who then has to make a recommendation to the mayor. Mayor then makes a recommendation to the council. So we're at the very early stages of this. You are giving your blessing to the 3.85 and 7% rates that have been proposed by the bureaus, respectively.
We're waiting for the final BAC reports, and then what PERB does formally is look at the BAC reports, and then we usually concur with that because we've sat on the BAC. So that's where sitting on these subcommittees makes a big difference, that we've already followed the arguments all the way through. So from a water subcommittee, yes, we would concur with the BAC recommendations.
Yeah.
Because we've been involved in that.
And BES has the BAC for BES has a letter in draft form that should be making its way to you shortly that indicates that, yes, we're on board with the full increase as well.
And then PERB will take all of those and look at all of them and make a recommendation for the way we did in our annual report. We will send you that recommendation, but usually there are no surprises because we've been involved in the process from the very beginning.
Two things I'd say on that subject, though. PERB will make a recommendation if we can get a quorum, and we need to get some people appointed and reappointed so that we can officially vote on that. I know that's under in process, but